We are in Tempe, Arizona at the Education Innovation Summit put on by Arizona State University. One of the speakers we met and talked with recently at the Salk Institute on our meeting on the Education Prize Advisory Meeting, Michael Horn, formerly Executive Director of Education and co-founder of the InnerSight Institute, and co-author with Clayton Christensen of Disrupting Class, about disruptive innovation changing the way we think about school. So why don't we just concentrate on this to begin with? Two primary questions on the introductory booklet here. How do we educate in a rapidly changing world? How do we focus information and technology to produce meaningful change? Now, as we said on the way over here, are we actually been talking about this enough in your view, or is it still like sort of Brains R Us One, where everybody's trying to get teachers versus...
Yesterday I thought there was a lot of talk about technology, and today there's a lot of talk about policy. And I wonder if we're connecting it from technology to learning, ultimately, and that's what we should be focused about. I think it's been an impressive conference in a lot of ways, but... one of the questions with the market, the way it still is we focus a lot on how do we make teachers better teachers, rather than focusing on the downstream question that we all really care about, which is how do we make students better learners? And teachers obviously play a role in that. But I think we have to keep that ultimate question of learning front and center, which is different from teaching and its connotations and what it actually means.
I guess it's just human nature, but when you sort of put a group of people in a room, the blame starts being,
the blame game starts getting played.
So the current issue of Time magazine, then, should schools bribe kids?
Yeah.
Cover story.
Yeah.
Amanda Ripley.
Yeah.
Story. A major new study reveals an uncomfortable truth. It can work if it's done right. Are you surprised about this?
It's a good thing I've read this story before you threw that on me. So it comes out of some interesting work that Roland Fryer at Harvard is doing. And he has an interesting... I heard him about a year ago on the Milken conference at a panel there. And he said, here I am, an economist and statistician of many years, well-learned, who had thought he had seen every statistical technique come his way. And then I got to education, and I learned about a new test I had never heard of. It's called the Hart test. Maybe you've heard of it, but he said, everyone's sitting there looking, can you feel it? Can't you feel that there's good being done here? And he said, that's the approach in education. No one ever wants to test and measure and see. And he said, I'm going to ask some really uncomfortable, interesting questions and see where we come out. And so this is the outgrowth of one of those uncomfortable questions he's asking, which is around incentivizing, in essence, students to perform better in certain tasks. And the findings are a little bit more nuanced than just bribing. What I think it points to is something that we talked about in the book, which is when there's extrinsic motivation at play, schooling is actually not something that's very challenging to convince kids that they need to attack, because it's an access to sort of a better life, an escape from poverty. But when extrinsic motivation is not present, that is, your prosperity is relatively assured or something like that, then you have to look at different motivators and get to much more intrinsic motivators to make the learning actually dare I say fun, but accord with relevant things in your life and so forth. And so I think he's playing at the intersection of those two things when he's doing this work on money. And one of the things that people have tended to find is that cash rewards in the wrong way, that are just pure extrinsic motivators, don't seem to last beyond the actual task. When they seem to develop intrinsic motivation and something a student can actually control, then they tend to be more effective.
Yeah. So now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that his name associated with Jeff Canada's as well, the
yes.
Harlem Project and so
yes.
on? So they worked together on that.
Yeah, that's correct, I believe. Jeffrey's project obviously is the Harlem Children's Zone. And I think Roland Fryer is brought in to measure certain aspects of that and ask questions about the idea of wrapping your arms around the entire life of a child, if I'm not mistaken, rather than just sort of point solution interventions, which a lot of education reform tends to look like. We tend to, I'm diverting a little bit from your question,
no,
but
fine.
It's an area of interest we've grown interested in, which is this notion that we try to find a solution and scale it. Whereas sometimes the question might be actually getting the scope right and wrapping your hands around an interdependent problem before worrying about scale right away. I don't know that we always, our theory of action is always right on which comes first there.
Okay. One of the interesting things from the panel I was listening to, and this I think is up your street when we're talking about disrupting technology.
Yeah.
The use of, say, computers as a platform mm-hmm. in schools and so on. The talk by Google's education evangelist, mm-hmm. Jamie Cassatt.
Yeah.
He was basically saying that he'd been in somewhere in Africa, for example, was talking to an education superintendent or whatever the equivalent is. The man is making a case for saying we need more computers. And behind him, a kid's doing exactly what you said, which is using an information processing device to their heart's content.
Yeah.
So is the question not necessarily what the platform is, but access to the information processing technology of whatever kind, and possibly the smaller and the simpler and the more portable, the better?
Yeah, I think that's a really good framing that you just chose of it, because it's rarely the case that we extend access to the most expensive experts or products or services. We didn't replicate the mainframe computer so everyone had a mainframe in their house. We've gotten access to computing by commoditizing the things that made the mainframe work by disrupting it gradually piece by piece. So it went from the mainframe to the mini computer to the workstation to the personal computer to the notebook, netbook, and now handhelds are computing. And if I'm not mistaken, the power on a BlackBerry or an iPhone represents the total computing power in the world from a few decades ago. So these are really powerful things that we're doing for a lot less money and a lot more accessible to many more people. So I think that's how you bring out these changes, not by trying to somehow enable access to something that's fundamentally expensive or inaccessible to people. You try to commoditize that.
Because you and Clay Christensen in that book, Disrupting Technologies, in fact, gave the example of the mainframe.
Yes.
And then way back when the very first Mac came out, wasn't it? And there were people were buying it for kids.
Yes.
Because there was no market. The market was completely empty.
Yeah. Literally as a toy for children.
A toy for children. But of course, everybody went for it.
Yeah, and there's a famous quote, right, from the CEO of Digital Equipment Corporation that was the leader in mini computers that said, there's no market for having a computer at everyone's desktop.
So I just had a conversation with Chris Whittle. And he was saying that he was working on a new school, and one of the things that he wanted in that school was for everybody, as they walked through the door, to be given an iPad. And I'm very sympathetic to that. I mean, behind us over there is the Science Network's website, and if people go at home and look at it, thesciencenetwork.org, they'll see that we're roughly in the shape of an iPad, and it fits very nicely on there. So I would love everybody to be walking around showing each other.
Yeah.
But in terms of what we've just been talking about, disruptive technologies, I think I'm speculating that they're moving far more towards that kind of a device.
Mm-hmm. Than Apple is, or the education?
That kind of a device,
yeah.
Which would free up teachers to become coaches, enthusiasts, evangelists, rather than supervisory drones.
I think that's right. I think as you have access to all of the information, it's not the case that we necessarily need a learning platform.
I was not putting down teachers as...
No. But it's not the case that we necessarily need the learning platform. We already have that. It's called the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
People need access to that. And so the more we get devices like the iPad that are small, durable, a lot less expensive than previous computers were. And I happen to think there's going to be a whole class of devices we can't even imagine still that the iPad doesn't even come close to representing that's going to be exciting. Then we get access to these sorts, kids get access to these sorts of information. I think one thing that I would say to the conference that we've had here that I think has been a bit of a flawed framing as well, is people keep talking about, well, once we get into the classroom, then it'll magically transform. I don't think that's quite right. I think teachers, because we're still limiting the idea of teacher to one to many, if we're thinking of it as a conventional classroom bounded by the four walls, the exciting thing is when students have access to, yes, the adult figure who's local to them, but also the content expert who is at MIT, the content expert who's developing something neat in India, peers anywhere around the world that they can collaborate and do things with. And so to some extent, I think that's why we called the book Disrupting Class. I think the idea of school or some community center persists because of all the social jobs we call on those things to do for in our lives that Chris Whittle is talking a lot about some of his central insights. But the notion of class bounded in this way, in this very archaic industrial model, I think that's going to get disrupted in some significant ways, and we're going to have a much more open way of thinking about learning and education.
Well, let me take another play on that word class and talk about
Social
class and the race.
Yes.
Margaret Spellings, who was just on a panel there, former U.S. Secretary of Education, very vocal, made a point about this is basically a sea of white faces out there. That's not what we should be looking at. How do we invoke and transform this so that it's getting to the over 50% of people who are
not represented. And Dr. Howard Fuller, who's been a stalwart, I'd say, in sort of the school choice movement and representing African American voices, he makes the same point. He says, it's nice that everyone here is working on this problem, but you actually need voices like mine and like others in here that actually understand these circumstances better. And can advocate for these to actually create change. So I don't pretend to be able to put myself in those shoes, but I think there's something really interesting and visceral about it, because to some extent I think we can disrupt the learning job, but there's also this social pyramid architecture that floats through, it's not just education, it's the economy, it's everything in life, which school actually gives us access to networks that get us in advance. There's a lot of other value that comes from this. And so how we think about that and what the price points are and what does exclusivity look like toward a network and how do we value that, those are going to be a lot of questions that get sorted out in some really interesting ways, I think. Chris Whittle's project, it sounded like, it was the first time I'd heard about it, sort of is going to blow through geographical barriers in thinking about that. But how do we think about blowing through class barriers and race barriers and so forth is going to be another dimension of that I think we have to give further thought to. It's probably not the case that just by opening up Harvard to millions of people you solve that problem, because the reason Harvard's desirable is precisely because it's exclusive.
Yeah. So to go back to the question that we raised at the last meeting where we were together, the notion of coming up with some sort of incentive-driven approach to innovation education, possibly an educational X Prize. As I look at some of the statistics in this ASU Innovation Education meeting, 101 million children of primary school age across the globe are not in school. U.S. 15-year-olds score lower than 31 countries in math, 22 in science. 70% of U.S. 8th graders can't read at the 8th grade level, and on with a litany of defects, which Chris Whittle did say, by the way, that recognizing these things is at least something that we do very well in the United States and work on it, work on it. But did you have any sense of optimism about the issues we discussed at the XPRIZE challenge meeting, being able to solve some of these
problems
huge
that we see?
Issues,
I think I did. I thought we had a really interesting conversation that took a lot of twists and turns throughout the day, but it ended up in areas from my perspective that have opportunities to drive a market around it, two in particular around early childhood learning, where there is far from ubiquitous access to that. We know that there are certain things that some kids get in the form of language, exposure to language and so forth. It develops the brain in ways that allows them to be more successful as they go on in life. And there are I think there are market-driven approaches that could start to help that, which is what the XPRIZE is about. And then the other area was really in credit recovery for students that are at risk. And if they don't recover those credits, will be dropouts. With no opportunity right now to have access to ways to make up those credits. So it's another market-driven area where there isn't the incumbent force that's aligned against it. And we can see a way to start to create something that really would drive it. And the advantage, I think, of the XPRIZE is the idea of driving it at a price point that can make it even more accessible to many more people. And that's exciting because of the innovators we might engage, not just people who've been in education or been in early childhood or been in online learning that we've gotten excited about, but people who come from far afield who might look at the problem totally different way and do something we can't imagine today.
Yeah. The one point that I would stress, though, and I want to see if you agree with me on this, is that I think what we bring to this, that particular group that was convened, because it was convened by the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, an NSF-funded organization, which is focusing on learning, how to build a better learner at different time scales from synapse to schoolroom. Yep. That even when you're talking, it's obvious how that works in the 0 to 3 age group, because brains are highly plastic and there's lots of wonderful research going on. When you get to that 8th grade to 9th grade transition, it sounds more like it's a kind of scholastic merchandising fix of some kind. I would claim that the neuroscience actually has a very strong acupressure point at that there as well, and that we should be focusing on the neuroscience in both of those areas to see how that can improve.
I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I think it's an exciting potential to leapfrog past some of the debates around assessment and is it valid, is it really creating change, is this what we want to be measuring? Because this is really going down to the root cause level of what enables people to be successful and to learn and be lifelong learners and all the rest, which is at that function. And that's really where we need to drive a lot more research. So I think it's going to have a twin effect. One is to leapfrog some of these debates and drive toward real learning. But secondly, to allow us to do a lot more research and learning about the brain and what that looks like as well, because it'll drive sort of a market that is shooting at that point far more than just a given and quite possibly flawed IQ test or something like that, to something much deeper, which should drive more research around that area, which we could certainly use. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but as I've delved into it, it's certainly true that we know some really fascinating things about the way the brain works and plasticity and certain key development points. But it's also the case that we have a lot to learn, and we still don't understand the root causes of a lot of those mechanisms. And it could be an exciting opportunity. In my mind, health and education are actually going to meld in some really interesting ways in the future. Already probably should, but are going to drive there, and this could help that, I think.
So in a sense, that if there is to be a remedial scholastics, then it should at least be built on a platform of sensible neurodiagnostics of some kind.
I think that's right, and there's not a lot of people looking at that question. There's a couple people at this conference at ASU who I know focus on the cognitive and neuroscience when they build their learning architectures and their various organizations, but there's not a lot. And so I think it would be that could be a clarion call to the industry, I think.
How did you get into this business, by the way, just as a matter of interest? Yeah. Is this a sort of a lifelong passion or something?
I stumbled into it by accident. I have to be honest. I out of college, I had a writing background and I worked in politics or in political landscape, I'd say. And I went to business school to try to escape both and run away from it. And while I was there, I took Clay Christensen's class, which totally transformed the way I saw the world from an innovation perspective.
Right.
But it was really broad applicability about cause and effect in a lot of different realms. And midway through the class, he just said, you know, I have this opportunity to co-author a book with me on education. If anyone's interested, come on by.
Right.
And I happened to be meeting with him about a paper I was doing for the class. And at the very end, I said, you know, I have a writing background. Mm-hmm. I have a bit of a political background and some interest in education and some background there. If you'd have me on, I don't think it's something I'd say no to, even though it's not what I plan to do. So it was supposed to be a year-long project, but 5 years later, whatever it is now, I see no sign of leaving anytime soon. So.
And it's been a fruitful trajectory for you.
Terribly so. It's been fantastic.
So do you, the intersection between the scientists and economists and the education community, I think that seems to be very fruitful. I'm thinking of not only of somebody like Clay Christensen, but also of somebody like James Heckman, Nobel Prize winning economist at Chicago, who's written very much about, you know, human assets and the neurobiology underpinning all of that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I had a conversation with Clay recently about the people at CAST. I don't know if you know that organization in northern Massachusetts. That's an outgrowth of people at the Harvard Ed School, who talk about the different ways people learn and try to create a universal design for learning is sort of their mission statement. And they came to us and said, you know, the causal mechanism of why organizations struggle to innovate is actually very similar to a lot of the areas that we see with the human brain and about how it processes information. We call it different things, but we actually have, it maps perfectly on the organizational thing. We should really write an article together. And I brought it up to Clay, and he said, you know, it's funny. The same is true in evolutionary biology, teams, team dynamics. And so it's like scholars in each of these areas keep discovering these causal underpinnings and think they've come up with the new world. And actually, it maps very similarly across a lot of sectors. And having that cross-disciplinary conversation, I think, would be really useful for a lot of endeavors.
Well, as you know, that's something that the Science Networks spend some time in, the silo destruction business. And as it happens, it's something that Michael Crow here at ASU is very concerned to do, is build transdisciplinary
institutions. I was really impressed by that. As we've started to turn to higher education, one of the things that jumps out of us is that there's sort of two fundamental types of universities, if you will. One's the research, and there's a teaching university. And to talk about the research one for a moment, it's been organized by disciplines because historically that was the way research was done. That was certainly the way you got tenure, was by publishing in narrower and narrower academic journals pertaining to your line of research. And it flies in the face. So there's some sense to that, but it also flies in the face of what we know, which is that the major breakthroughs at a lot of these disciplines have been from people who've come at it orthogonally from outside of the field that were able to see something slightly different and reframe a question. And so it sort of ignores that potential and brings the silos. And I just, the way he's almost sounded like a wrecking ball through those different silos was quite impressive, because I think that's where it'll leave Arizona State in good stead, but also do great things for research community across the world, I would imagine.
Yeah. So we'll be setting up another continuation of this meeting. What's your sense at this point? I mean, are you optimistic about? It's just such a huge problem.
There are days in education where you just want to drive off a cliff, because it just seems like there's another problem you hadn't thought of. There's no end in sight. I'm generally by nature a pretty optimistic person. And I tend to be pretty optimistic about the point in time where we are right now. And I think there's a lot of good innovation happening. I suspect it won't be fast enough for a lot of people, because it is a process and there's still a lot we don't know. But I'm also sort of comfortable with that process. I'll call it a disruptive process. It doesn't turn the world over in one day. It happens over some years. But I think that process is good, because if we turn the world over tomorrow, somehow we had that power, I think we'd have to have the humility to say we'd get it not quite right, and maybe a lot more wrong than we would hope. And what I hope from a gradual process that can iterate and learn from itself is that over time we can tick and tack back to a place where we feel much more excited. And I suspect the demands of society are going to continue to change too, such that we don't want a system, another system that's rooted in place as well. And so having a system that can learn from itself would be a much richer place of doing it. And I'm optimistic that there's some really exciting areas of that going on. And I think this conference at ASU has brought out a lot of those pockets where we see it, and we see it starting to scale in a lot of those places. Reed Hastings talked about it yesterday in his talk. You don't create change by going at the belly of the beast. You go in the soft spots, and everyone's taking off a different piece right now. And at some point, there'll be a massive consolidation when this has to come to sort of roost. But I think it's a really exciting time right now to be in the field, so I am optimistic on the whole.
Well, it seems like the best way to do this is scientifically, which is why we talk about a science of educating.
Yeah.
And
the scientific process really has a lot to teach us in not just how we think of science, but how we build theory in all fields. And I think we've ignored it too long in business, education, all sorts of fields. And we could really use that process to bear on as we do this.
The connection between science and education, we've talked about this, is obvious. We've just had the results announced for the Race to the Top. Mm-hmm. We were actually in Tennessee mm-hmm. with Camilla Bembo at the Peabody College when those results came out announcing that Tennessee had got an award and so on. But we're also talking about the science with her and with all the other people at Vanderbilt as well. President Obama, when he came into office, said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. Without giving any coordinates.
Right.
So I've been asking people as we go through all of this, what do you think is the rightful place of science? And you may have a very specific education spin on this, but...
I have to think about that. What occurs... God, there's like five different things that impact on this, right? Because there's the aspect of it that we're launching reforms right now that don't necessarily have scientific bearing on learning.
Right.
So there's that aspect of it, and so there's a question, are we doing what we could be doing? There's the question of just merely by opening it up more, are we going to allow for more scientific things to happen? There's the question I have, which is rather than focusing on a competition to get the right circumstances, if we focused on results, wouldn't we drive the back end of that? Because you'd have to underpin to science. And I don't mean results in sort of a punitive aftermath way, but actually tying the education market right now is really screwed up in that it doesn't value one intervention that works better than another.
How do you mean?
If you go to a district to sell a product or a service, everyone has a study that has some sort of hockey stick with when you use theirs versus something else. And there's no good ways of...
Adjudicating
or determining quality, and there's not a real good sense of what that means in the education market. It's a huge problem right now. And so people tend to migrate to unseemly ways of making those decisions on what to use for curriculum or curriculum and the like, interventions, whatever. And I sort of feel like if districts came to, when a provider came to a district to sell them something or to offer them something, if they said, well, that looks fascinating, we'd be happy to adopt it, and we'll only pay you if it works for the students for whom it works. And so I might have an implementation for 10 students then, and you'll get whatever the funds is for 10 students, and I'll be using something totally different for 20 over here. And well, that would really tie us to something real and true north. I don't know if that answered your question, but there's that aspect of it. I don't know if we're still focusing enough on the competency and mastery question and tying it to funds at all levels. It's not necessarily a punitive thing. It's how we do business in a lot of other sectors to align incentives in the right way. So that's one thing I guess I think about when you say restoring science to its rightful place. The other one I guess I'd say is being honest that at any one time, science doesn't have the final answer either. It's an evolving process, and that's what makes science so rich and have been so helpful to us. And I guess so there's a certain humility there, but there's also a certain utility. And so I don't know that it's saying the answer
right.
at any one point, but it's sort of this is the best evidence, let's keep these questions out there and see how, and acknowledge the anomalies and being honest with that. That would be restoring science, I think, to its true place, would be also looking at anomalies in fields. And I guess the third thing in terms of education specific is when we wrote our chapter on developing good theory in disrupting class, which is really just the scientific method, yeah. We got a lot of pushback from people who said, education's an art. And it is right now, because we haven't had good science to inform it at the level it needs to be. But the way we get to the ability to commoditize and extend access to great things is by making something first from art and intuition to patterns to rules-based. And in healthcare right now, we're sort of in the patterns to rules-based, somewhere in the between there. Education right now, we're somewhere in between art and intuition and patterns. We need to get a lot more aggressive to bring it down the pipeline right now and be a lot more accepting that there's certain things we can do that on, I think. There's other things that will remain in the realm of intuition, I'm sure, but we ought to be at least bring that exploration and that research lens to it to try to drive this far faster than we are right now. And there's a surprising amount of opposition, I find, to it.
Well, in those couple of discussions I was listening to just now, there was this, as I said, this inveighing against school boards or mm-hmm. against teachers who have tenure who should no longer be teaching. There were lots of yeah. culprits being identified. Mm-hmm. But the culprits, a lot of them did seem to have a great deal of say in what was happening, yeah. as you said in there. It was their, this is what we've been doing, this is what we think works. Not a hypothesis-driven test
yeah.
result
That's right.
performing solution, which I think you'd say is more of a scientific way of going about it.
I think so.
Is this working?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, so there's two ways to go about that. One is to pick the fights at the system and try to change it, which some people have been doing. The other way is to disrupt it by starting in places where the system isn't or the system doesn't want to be and allowing it to gain market share and showing quality and people one by one migrate over it as it brings forth new value propositions that we can tangibly say they value. Mm-hmm. And what I think I like about that way is it's more productive. It gets gains right away. And secondly, it acknowledges that the players in a system act the way they do because of the way the system is interdependent with itself. And so it's hard to expect someone in one part of it to really act differently because it's all an outgrowth of how the system weaves into together. It's not the case that it's one bad apple or that people have bad intentions. Mm-hmm. And so having that systems perspective on it, I think, is important, too, that you can actually craft a new system much more easily than you can transform an entire existing system.
Well, this is part of an ongoing series of conversations. So until the next time, Michael Hall, thanks very much.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me.